Today is Wednesday, April 21st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. President Idriss Deby Itno, who ruled Chad for more than 30 years, died Tuesday. What impact will his death have on those who follow?
I'm not sure the army will fully support the rapidly established Transitional Military Council.
Plus, former police officer Derek Chauvin is found guilty in the death of George Floyd. And we take a look ahead at Earth Day 2021. We'll have these stories and more next. President Idriss Deby Itno, who ruled Chad for more than 30 years and became an important ally to Western nations in the fight against Islamic extremism in Africa, has been killed while battling rebels in the north. He was 68 years old. The news of his death was announced Tuesday by the military and came hours after he had been declared the winner of an election that would have given him another 6 years in power. The circumstances of his death remain murky, and his son was quickly appointed to lead a transitional council that will last up to 18 months. The Chadian army has blamed the rebel group, the Front for Change and Concord in Chad, or FACT, for Deby's death. FACT has been based in Libya to Chad's north and is linked to Libyan rebel general Khalifa Haftar. Now, to find out more about the FACT group, the details of Deby's death, VOA's Jason Patinkin reached out to Chad researcher Jerome Tubiana in France.
It's pretty much a classical Chadian rebel group. Its leader, Mohamed Mahdi, has been a really long-time rebel. He was part of actually the early Chadian rebellion since the 1970s. I think at the time he was pretty much a child soldier rebel. And since then he's been a rebel in various movements. And then he was also in exile in France for a long time, and he went to Libya to take the leadership of the rebels who had moved from Sudan and North Chad to Libya in the year 2015. And then actually they started to splinter, and he found himself literally trapped into the area controlled by General Haftar in Libya. He managed to conclude some kind of non-aggression pact with Haftar and to somehow work alongside him. But it's a bit odd because Haftar is also very close to the Chadian government and the French government. So you had on the same side Chadian rebels and the Chadian government in Libya.
Now, it's the army who announced that the rebels killed Deby. Is that confirmed by any other sources?
There was also a lot of information from the rebels, and there are not that much difference between the government information and the rebel information on the fighting itself, including on the fact that there were heavy losses from both sides, including on the side of the army. At least five generals were killed, according to both the rebels and the government. And ultimately, I got the information that Deby was killed, or actually died from his injuries, from sources very close to the rebels. So it looks like it's confirmed, and I don't see much difference between both versions.
And, you know, it's quite surprising for a head of state to be killed on the battlefield. From the Chadian government perspective, what went wrong here?
It's not the first time that Deby goes to fight himself and to lead the troops, to lead operations on the ground. He already did it in 2008 and was almost killed. And even this time, I heard before he was injured, he was almost killed at the same time than two generals. At that time was not injured, and then he was injured the next day, according to what I heard. So it's customary and in Chad to do that, and people say that the troops don't fight if the big officers are not in the first car, basically, on the front line. The result of that is that losses of big officers are common. I think Deby also wanted to make sure that his army would actually fight and remain mobilized and not betray him, because in recent years, there's been a lot of dissatisfaction growing within the army.
You mentioned this dissatisfaction. Are there any fractures in the Chadian military so far?
There were indications of fractures in the army in recent years. The army remobilized to fight in the last days, but it's not sure that it will remain as mobilized now that Deby is dead. I'm not sure the army will fully support the rapidly established transitional military council.
And looking at that council, the head of that council is Debi's son. What do we know about him? Does he have the political and military skills that his father had, who, of course, ruled for 30 years?
Well, the council is led by Mohamed Kaka, who is one of Debi's son and also a military high rank. He does not have the same history than Debi. He's a young man. He was never a rebel. He got his some legitimacy a few years ago when he was named as the commander of the Chadian forces in Mali. He managed there to get some popularity, including with the French army officers fighting there. But still, it doesn't mean that Chad is game for a family or dynastic transition. I think it would be difficult to imagine that anyone from Debi's family could actually succeed Debi after such a long time in power. The Chadian population likely needs to see new faces, and probably from other communities and not only military faces, but civilians as well.
And last of all, you mentioned France, who was a close ally of Debi. What does his death mean for the French?
I think what's been happening in the last days is a big failure for France, because France has heavily supported Debi politically and militarily in recent years, without making much pressure on him for making plans for his succession or beginning a democratic transition or an inclusive dialogue. Debi and France are heavily responsible for giving the Chadians the feeling that you need to take arms if you want any political change to happen in this country.
Chad researcher Jerome Tubiano was speaking to VOA's Jason Patinkin. The United Nations Children's Fund warns the conflict in Ethiopia's northern Tigray province is stripping tens of thousands of children of their rights, plunging them into a protection crisis that's causing them unimaginable long-lasting harm. Lisa Schlein takes it from here.
UNICEF spokesman James Elder has just returned from a visit to Ethiopia's Tigray. He says his agency's fears for the welfare of children expressed at the onset of the conflict nearly 6 months ago now are being realized. Elder says children are suffering from a protection crisis as the incidence of rape and gender-based violence grows. Since the start of the year, he says just one UNICEF-supported center has been reporting an average of three cases of gender-based violence every day. Those are the reported cases, he says, adding the true number is certainly higher.
The personal stories I received from children who had been raped, or testimony of women who were victims of sexual violence, were harrowing and quite cruel. Yes, I heard traumatic stories of, you know, children as young as 14. I heard reports of gang rapes, quite bewildering.
Elder says authorities must publicly denounce the attacks and hold the perpetrators accountable. He says UNICEF is providing medical and psychosocial support to the survivors of sexual assault. He says children caught in the conflict also are suffering from education and nutritional emergencies. He says 1.4 million children have not been in school for more than a year. Of the many children he encountered on his visit to Tigray, Elder says the story of 16-year-old Merhawit remains seared in his mind.
She had walked 300 kilometres with her baby brother on her back from the west of the country amid pretty intense fighting. There was 300 kilometres and in broken flip-flops. Those stories abound. She was, you know, a star in physics, and now she's searching for food and hasn't seen a classroom in a year.
Last November, fighters from the Tigray People's Liberation Front attacked army bases in the region, according to the federal government. The attack, Ethiopia's prime minister said, prompted his government to launch a military offensive to push the group out. The conflict has interrupted harvesting activities, resulting in lost income and livelihoods. And now, because of the fighting, farmers cannot access their land to plant their crop, resulting in severe food shortages. Elder says that is causing a spike in malnutrition, with an increasing number of acutely malnourished children requiring life-saving treatment. He says UNICEF requires greater international support to meet the many protections protection, education, and nutritional needs of Tigray's children and women. He notes less than half of UNICEF's $47.6 million appeal for Tigray is funded. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
On Tuesday, the jury returned verdicts in the trial of former Minneapolis, Minnesota policeman Derek Chauvin, accused of killing George Floyd last May. Hennepin County District Judge Peter Cahill read the decisions.
We, the jury, in the above-entitled matter as to count one, unintentional second-degree murder while committing a felony, find the defendant guilty.
In addition, the jury found Chauvin guilty of third-degree murder and manslaughter in the deadly arrest of George Floyd. The verdict is seen as a milestone in the fraught racial history of the United States and a rebuke of law enforcement's treatment of black Americans. Chauvin had pleaded not guilty to charges of second-degree unintentional murder involving intentional infliction of bodily harm, third-degree unintentional depraved mind murder involving an act eminently dangerous to others, and second-degree manslaughter involving a death caused by culpable negligence. Chauvin was remanded into custody to await sentencing that will take place in 8 weeks. Under Minnesota sentencing guidelines, Chauvin faces 12 and a half years in prison for his murder conviction as a first-time criminal offender. Prosecutors could, however, seek a longer sentence, up to the maximum of 40 years, if Hennepin County District Judge Cahill, who presided over the trial, determines that there were aggravating factors. In Minnesota, convicted criminals generally leave prison on supervised release after completing two-thirds of their sentence. Chauvin had no previous criminal convictions. Several doctors have been prevented from seeing Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny at a prison hospital after his three-week hunger strike. Authorities, meanwhile, have stepped up actions against his supporters on the eve of protests called by his team. His supporters also say that Russian police detained allies of Navalny on Tuesday and raided two of his regional offices. Navalny was transferred Sunday from a penal colony east of Moscow to a prison hospital in Vladimir, east of the capital, and his lawyers and associates have said that his condition has dramatically worsened. Reports about his rapidly deteriorating health have drawn international outrage and concern. U.S. Ambassador to Moscow John Sullivan said on Tuesday that he would travel to the United States this week for consultations, 4 days after the Kremlin suggested that Washington recall him amid a diplomatic crisis between the two countries. Russia recalled its own ambassador to Washington last month after U.S. President Joe Biden said that he thought his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, was a killer. And the two countries imposed new sanctions on one another last week. You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Steve Miller. The U.S. government on Tuesday announced a 100-day plan to improve the cybersecurity of the nation's electric infrastructure, calling it an urgent challenge. I got the details from VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman.
There's tremendous concern, Steve, about connections between the electrical grid and the internet. Obviously, anything connected to the internet, there's all sorts of ways that outsiders can get into it. And this is a real concern because someone, either a criminal hacker or a foreign government, could get into the U.S. electrical grid and not only mess around with it, but possibly turn out the lights for thousands and thousands of people. Now, that might seem inconceivable, but it's happened before in Ukraine in 2015 and 2016. Russia both times was blamed with carrying out actions that caused power to go out in that country.
Steve, did you get a sense that the Biden administration is also doing this perhaps in the wake of the SolarWinds hack, which was that massive attack on computers in the United States that the government has placed the blame on Russia?
Yeah, we've been asking officials about that, and they're denying that this is linked directly to the SolarWinds and the Microsoft Exchange software attacks and data breaches. They're saying that this is a bit of a pilot project to do this for other parts of the U.S. infrastructure. But when we see something like a 100-day plan rolled out, that obviously denotes a sense of urgency, and the National Security Council's describing this as an aggressive plan, but they believe that it is achievable, and both the government and the industry are pledging to work together to make some changes pretty quickly.
100 days is not a lot of time to get something done. What does the Biden administration have already planned to move forward to get their plan underway?
Well, they have cooperation with a number of groups that represent industry. Both the government and the utility industry have been talking about these sort of things for a long time. And there was some criticism by industry recently when this $2 trillion infrastructure plan was rolled out, and it really didn't seem to contain any money to try to bolster these systems. So what we're seeing today looks like a way to address that, although we're not seeing any dollar figures attached to it immediately.
Steve Herman is VOA's White House Bureau Chief. The United States Strategic Command warned the U.S. Armed Services Committee about the threats Russia's and China's nuclear programs pose. VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden shared the details.
The commander of U.S. Strategic Command, Admiral Charles Richard, told lawmakers Tuesday that the landscape in terms of the nuclear threat that the United States is facing has changed significantly. He said for much of the past two, 3 decades, the U.S. has really been bracing itself and preparing for a potential nuclear confrontation with one nuclear adversary, and that would be Russia. He said that's no longer the case, and that China, in his words, is at some kind of inflection point and is on pace to double their nuclear stockpile by the end of the decade.
Now, you talk about extra deterrence that the admiral was calling for. Did he give any idea of what the United States was looking to develop?
The big argument has been, and what the commander of Strategic Command tried to emphasize to lawmakers, is the need for what's been called nuclear modernization. A lot of the U.S. nuclear arsenal is getting old. In some cases, it was designed, and you have systems that work in an environment that has nothing to do with the internet, because when they were built, the internet didn't exist. In the meantime, according to U.S. military officials, Russia has modernized its nuclear weapons stockpile. That's 80% complete. They say that the U.S. is right now at zero. And of course, China's nuclear capabilities are all new and being built right now. So that puts the U.S. at a disadvantage. The commander of Strategic Command said sometimes for his forces, which oversee the U.S. nuclear stockpile, it's like trying to pull a rabbit out of the hat to make sure that nuclear weapons, nuclear missiles are ready and able to go should they be needed. And again, this is all presented in terms of presenting adversaries like Russia and China with a credible deterrent. They used to talk about something called mutually assured destruction. If one country launches nuclear missiles and then the other country launches nuclear missiles, everything is destroyed. But the thing that prevents everybody from doing that is that they'll both be destroyed because they both have nuclear weapons. He says that deterrent is becoming less credible because often the U.S. simply doesn't have these weapons at their disposal because they're not ready to go. They need repair. They're missing parts, or they're simply just getting older. And the guarantee that they will work as effectively as they need to simply isn't there anymore.
Jeff, one last question. What about the discussions that Washington and Moscow have been having about their arms control treaty? Where does that play into this?
Well, what we heard from the military officials was that they welcome those types of arms control treaties, provided that they're verifiable. The difficulty, of course, and you saw this under the last administration, under former President Donald Trump, was a debate for how to do it, because most of the nuclear weapons treaties and the arms control treaties are between the U.S. and Russia. China is not covered under those treaties. So the debate has been whether or not you need to redo the U.S.-Russia treaties to include China, or if the U.S. and Russia should continue to work on arms control and then use a separate mechanism to bring in China. The military officials didn't weigh in on what they thought of that, only that the more arms control treaties, the more that you have treaties and mechanisms in place that can verifiably reduce the threat, the better.
VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden. Former U.S. Vice President Walter Mondale, a liberal political icon from Minnesota, died at the age of 93. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn has this look back at his life.
In 1964, Walter Mondale was appointed to Minnesota's U.S. Senate seat, replacing his mentor, Hubert Humphrey. Mondale was known for his advocacy of social issues. In 1976, he was Jimmy Carter's running mate when they unseated Gerald Ford. Carter saying some 30 years later,
I felt the vice president would be the best one to give me the help I needed, and I never had served in Washington before, as you know, and Fritz was an expert.
And now eulogizing Mondale as the best vice president in our country's history. Mondale unsuccessfully ran for president in 1984, choosing a woman as his running mate, losing to Ronald Reagan in a landslide. He served as ambassador to Japan in the 90s. Mondale's wife, Joan, died in 2014, 3 years after their daughter, Eleanor. Mondale is survived by two sons. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Thursday is Earth Day, and U.S. President Joe Biden has invited 40 world leaders to a virtual summit on climate change. The United States is in a precarious position internationally after the Trump administration withdrew from the U.N. Paris Climate Agreement. Advocates expect Biden to turn things around, but delivering will not be easy. VOA's Steve Barragona reports.
We're going to rejoin the Paris Climate Accord as of today.
On his first day in office, President Joe Biden aimed to demonstrate that climate change would be at the top of his agenda. Biden's Earth Day summit intends to show world leaders that things have changed from the Trump administration's disregard for the issue.
It's an opportunity for the U.S. to come back onto the scene to show that it's taking climate change seriously.
The stakes are rising. The consequences of climate change are becoming ever more apparent, with more wildfires, deeper droughts, and stronger storms. The 2015 UN Paris Climate Agreement aimed to put a lid on global warming, but experts say the goal set in Paris is slipping away.
We're at grave risk right now. We're seeing temperatures continuing to climb. We're seeing emissions continuing to climb, going in the opposite direction from where they need to. And that's why so many are calling this a make-or-break decade.
Global emissions have been on a steady upward path for decades. Current policies will continue adding to the problem. But Wasco says emissions need to fall by nearly half by 2030 to be on a path that avoids the worst impacts of climate change.
If you don't start bending that curve now, the trajectory that one would have to be on following 2030 is just, you know, one that would be incredibly difficult to achieve.
Advocates are calling on Biden to announce a 50% cut in U.S. emissions by 2030. The White House says it will announce its target ahead of the summit. Biden sees opportunities in fighting climate change, like building solar and wind power and electric vehicle charging stations, jobs that cannot be shipped overseas. It's a cornerstone of his $2.3 trillion infrastructure plan.
The American Jobs Plan will lead to a transformational progress in our effort to tackle climate change with American jobs and American ingenuity.
But Congress would have to pass that plan, and Republicans are solidly opposed.
It is a massive expansion of the government, financed on the backs of the American taxpayers, with taxes that will hurt the economy and cost us jobs.
It's not clear the United States will make the cuts Biden wants. That weakens the U.S. position globally.
Until we can sort out those politics, it's going to be tough for us to claim this leadership mantle internationally on the top line numbers.
Meanwhile, eyes are on other major polluters, including China, the world's biggest, and India, a rising source, to announce their climate plans ahead of a major UN conference in Glasgow in November. Steve Barragona, VOA News.
Each year, Earth Day is set aside to celebrate the planet and to rededicate ourselves to learning about and protecting the robust yet delicate systems in which all life depends. Of special concern this year are the world's oceans. Now, they cover two-thirds of the world's surface, but oceans have historically been seen as too big to fail and its nutritious bounty too abundant to exhaust. Unfortunately, the Earth's oceans are threatened as never before. Pollution and human-caused climate change are major factors, but so is industrial overfishing, especially for the fish that are made into a powder used to feed farmed fish. Many of those fish meal plants are in West Africa. Now they'll find out more about fish meal farming and the ocean's crisis for Earth Day. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with journalist Ian Urbina, author of The Outlaw Ocean, Journeys Across the Last Untamed Frontier. Urbina is also the founder of the Outlaw Ocean Project, a nonprofit journalism organization dedicated to reporting on the intersection of human rights, labor, and ocean environmentalism.
In terms of the abuse when it comes to the marine environment, you have more than 80% of the world's fish stocks are at or beyond the point of collapse. They've been overfished. You also have a rampant problem of illegal fishing. So the state of affairs at sea are pretty bleak.
One major strategy that environmentalists talk about is to raise fish in farms on land or in pens close by the shore.
That's quite right. The problem there is that sort of fishing requires you to feed the fish, to fatten them up faster, get them to market. And so historically, to feed those fish in high protein fashion relied on soy. But in the last couple decades, we've shifted to grinding up fish into these pellets and powder called fish meal to feed to the other fish in the fish farms, which makes no sense because it's now accelerating the worsening of the problem that they were trying to solve, which is ocean depletion. And so you might have 1 pound of tuna equating to 25 pounds of wild-caught forage fish. So you're collapsing the food chain, essentially.
What sorts of fish do they use for fish meal?
The fish that end up as fish meal tend to be called forage fish or trash fish that tend to be smaller fish that are not economically viable to sell, but they're essential for the food chain within the marine environment.
And ultimately, the break in that chain means fewer large fish for humans to eat at the apex of the system.
It means less food for us. It also means the oceans die. If the seas run out of marine life, the oceans stop serving a key purpose. I mean, the ocean produces 50% of the air we breathe. It's a huge carbon sink, which is to say it filters the air. So it's not just a protein and sustenance issue for humans. It's also global stability. Climate change issue as well.
Where is the overfishing for fish meal most prevalent?
Africa, and specifically West Africa, is kind of the tip of the spear here when it comes to places in the planet where there's still a robust nearshore fish stocks that attracts the attention of huge foreign industrial commercial boats.
And a great, great many of those boats and factories are Chinese owned.
China is the big player. And Senegal, Mauritania, the Gambia, for example, are being combed for this very market. So in the last decade, 14 factories have been built in those three countries alone just to produce fish meal. And hundreds upon hundreds of large boats are in those coastal waters, scooping up fish that for centuries have been the main source of protein for local survival. The bonga fish, for example, in Gambia was so plentiful and essential that when you went to the market in Gambia, you would get bonga for free as you bought other types of fish. Now the bonga is hard to get. It's extremely expensive. And most of it that's caught is going into the fish meal plants to be ground up and exported for aquaculture farms, so that these foreign countries can feed cod or salmon or shrimp that then get resold to more expensive clients in the developed West. And to make the irony even darker, those Gambians that are now priced out of getting their own bonga are instead importing chicken from countries like China that are extracting the fish that they could be getting from their own waters.
I know that in your very intrepid reporting in West Africa, you found horrific labor conditions on the boats themselves. Give us some background.
On the boats that we boarded, these were Chinese boats in Gambian waters. They typically had a couple Chinese officers, and then the rest were African crew. And most of the crew were not actually Gambians. They were Senegalese because they're cheaper. And then the living conditions and working conditions on these boats generally are brutal. 20-hour work days and really unsafe sleeping conditions and no medicine if you get sick and not proper gear. So these guys are working in flip-flops or barefoot using dangerous equipment, etc. And so on this Earth Day, think about the people and the marine life that are beyond the horizon and educate yourself about what's happening to them, because what's happening at sea above and below the waterline matters a lot.
That was Ian Urbina, a journalist and author of The Outlaw Ocean, Journeys Across the Last Untamed Frontier. He was speaking to my colleague, Adam Phillips. And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.